I have a question from some remote viewers that were watching the stream. They were curious, is there a good way to follow these cases to learn of their outcome when the opinions are released, and how soon after oral arguments does that typically occur?
Who do you want to address that to? One of the attorneys?
I don't know, whoever could best answer it, I guess.
The court will conference today, take a preliminary vote. They will, an opinion will be written and circulated. At some time in May, they'll have a decision date, and when the opinion has been accepted, then that will be released. And so that would be my best guess, would be that it would be in May when people would understand or receive what the decision is in the case.
Great question, by the way. We've got the mics open for you. This is the opportunity.
Thank you. I think this is mostly towards the state in the first case. How often is this raised? I'm curious to know how often defendants try to raise a constitutional question to then raise the appeal, whether that's sort of a litigation strategy that is often deployed. I'd be very curious to hear.
This statute in particular, I don't think is enforced all that often. But in general, just challenges to the vagueness of a statute is actually, it's a pretty common challenge that defendants will raise. So that's pretty common.
And is that because the appeal goes directly to the Supreme Court here, or is there a reason why that's frequently raised?
I think it's just a common argument that's raised. The appeal only goes directly to the Supreme Court if they prevail. So anytime a trial court strikes down a statute, it automatically goes to the Supreme Court for resolution. But in probably the vast majority of cases, or in other cases where the trial court would deny that challenge and then the case goes to trial, then the defendant would just raise the challenge on appeal to the intermediate appellate court, and then it would only get to the Supreme Court if for whatever reason there was something unique about the case that got the Supreme Court to want to take it.
But overall, pretty common.
It is a pretty common type of challenge, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think I'd take advantage of it. This is when you're going to get free legal advice. So mics are wide open.
Yes, in the second case, the documents that were being sought that are now classified as confidential, I read your briefs briefly. The basis for the Institute for Justice for seeking these documents in this professional area, as well as Perry, if you got those documents, what would you use those documents for?
Well, with regard to the Perry case, specifically, there was a vague complaint lodged against his license. There was a hearing. The details of the complaint were never disclosed. The allegations themselves were never disclosed. And the matter was closed. However, when the department closed the matter, they sent him a letter saying, we're going to keep this in your file and we may use it against you in the future. So I think for that point, it's a matter of edification, because there's something in the file that they haven't disclosed and did not find meritorious, yet there's this sort of amorphous threat of future action. So to that extent, it's just more of a knowledge factor, which would be consistent with the public policy of transparency. I can let them speak as to the Institute.
Yes, so as for the Institute for Justice, they were asking for documents related to complaints against certain professional licensed individuals in the state, and they are participating in a large, I believe 50-state research project about quantitatively analyzing regulation on licensed professionals. I'll actually do a little bit of buzz marketing for them. I believe the research came out in 2016 with a footnote saying that they're still hoping to receive the documents from Illinois and that they'll update the research if that becomes available.
If I could have a follow-up on that, I saw there were three amici briefs in the second case. What did the lawyers do? Because normally you have to go out and get those types of briefs to get additional support. What was the thought behind getting additional people to weigh in on this case?
Yes, there was three amicus briefs in support of the appellants in this case, and I believe it was nine organizations in total signed on, including Illinois ACLU, Better Government Association, Illinois Press Association, Illinois Policy Institute. You know, this case raised a little bit of publicity in the Illinois FOIA world, as well as both, you know, the Institute for Justice and the groups have some connections in the field. But we actually were able to receive a lot of interest because there's a lot of organizations, from press to research organizations, that really need FOIA in order to understand the government. And they saw this as a particularly bad ruling that could undermine that. And they were, you know, happy to participate and put their names behind it. So, you know, undoubtedly the lawyers had some involvement in helping the amicus learn the case, but a lot of these groups really wanted to participate.
If nobody else has another question, go ahead, take it.
In the first case, the person that was talking for the people, I'm unsure of the writ hearing you were talking about, that she used the writ hearing.
Oh, could you repeat the question?
I wasn't sure of what writ hearing.
I was just trying to politely express the opinion that the point that they were making was sort of, you know, not exactly relevant to the issue that was before the court. It was sort of something that maybe seemed like it had relevance, but if you really sort of think about it a little bit more, it was like addressed to a different area. And so it was sort of
but I don't know exactly what you were talking about. I know what a red herring is, but I didn't know exactly what.
Oh, what was the red herring?
Yeah, what was
I think I was talking there about there were certain arguments that were being raised about whether the officer was confused. And so our argument was just that was not really what's at issue here.
So you were talking, the red herring in this was the officer?
Yes, that argument, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. We got another one over here. Good.
Hi. I'm 1L here at U of I. And we are currently in the process of creating briefs for our legal writing or advocacy classes, and we will do oral arguments in a few weeks. So I was just wondering if you guys had any general tips for someone who's never done anything like this before. Anything that you wish you had known when you were a first-year law student doing something like this?
Good. I'm not a law student, but we got a lot of attorneys up here that I'd be able to answer that one.
To say that the perfect person to speak to that would be Steve Beckett. He's been in front of Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, and this was my first time doing this, and he coached the whole way. So
what we did, and I don't know what the other attorneys do, but we did, is that we mooted this twice. So we had a law firm assemblage, and I actually think that the law firm questioning was much tougher than the questioning that we had for the Supreme Court, because we asked lots of questions that didn't get asked today. And I think the idea is by having your fellow law students who may be familiar with your case sit there and ask you questions about your case, it makes you think on your feet, it makes you have responses. And of course, I think all of the attorneys had prepared remarks. They had a structure to their argument. They had good openings and good conclusions. Those are very, very important. And I think all of the attorneys also tried to use the questions that the justices were asking to make the points that they wanted to make. You're always concerned. We had attorneys who didn't have enough time to make their complete argument, so they used the questions that the justices asked to make their points, and that's something you should always try to do as well.
Did that answer your question?
Good. For the state in the first case, I was wondering what was the most difficult question or the most difficult point to respond to that the defense made.
That's a really good question. I'm sort of constrained in what I can say. It's our general policy not to really comment on the merits of pending litigation. So I don't want to get too much into the arguments of the case. But I think, you know, they made some very strong points, and I think we feel like we made some strong points in response. I would say that probably from just a rhetorical perspective, the toughest point to respond to is just their general argument about fairness and ensuring that citizens have fair notice of what the laws say.
You can stay. My question's for you. I actually have a two-part question, but
okay,
for the people, and I apologize if I just stole your spot, sir. My question is, I want to completely understand from the standpoint of the people, is it the position of the people that the statute reads that a low-speed gas bicycle should not, irregardless of all the very, very specific two-wheel under one horsepower, that gas bicycle should not exceed 20 miles per hour, period?
I'm constrained about what I can say, and it's just probably not appropriate for me to get into the merits.
Understandable.
I do know that the court on their website has posted all of the parties' briefs, which do get into a lot more detail than what we're able to get into today. So if anybody's interested, I think they're probably still up there, and you can read the briefs on the website.
Perfect. I respect that. Thank you very much. May I ask a second part Plank's counsel, if I might? I just wanted to ask if the people stayed away from the 170 pounds very much. And I wonder if it might be consideration of Mr. Plank, that since he weighed so much less and then the 170 pounds, perhaps he knew at the time he was 155 pounds, let's say, and it's 170 pounds for 20 miles an hour. If a reasonable person, if that would agree with your position, that perhaps a reasonable person might infer that since I weigh less, I will be able to ride this bike more than 20 miles per hour.
Yes, so is your question, would a reasonable person infer that?
Yeah, would your position be that a reasonable person could infer that, thus the super specificity of this statute thereby causes vagueness?
No, I think our position was just that we don't know. So if you're not 170 pounds, we don't know. We could infer, we could guess, we could say, well, you could go slower, you could go faster. But I think the point is that it's the General Assembly's job to tell us, and so that we're not guessing. And so that was our position.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon. I'm an attorney in Michigan. And my question is mostly about the general practice of the Supreme Court here. It seems that in the last few years, or several years actually, the Michigan Supreme Court has started issuing decisions in more cases solely on the briefs, cases where they're not hearing arguments. Does the Illinois Supreme Court very often issue substantive decisions without argument?
Yeah, no, they almost never issue decisions without having heard oral argument. I can think of maybe like less than a handful of cases in the past couple of years where that's happened, but almost invariably they will have full briefing and oral argument.